Thanks for joining us here at Radio Who, What, Why. A lot of people speculate about what might have happened to Bobby Kennedy in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel that night exactly 50 years ago. Much of the speculation is informed by great research, good reporting, and even cutting-edge science. But nothing compares with talking to those that were there when the assassination happened. Paul Schrade was a longtime friend and political ally of Kennedy's. He himself was shot in the head that night, but recovered from his wounds. 2 years ago, when he was at the age of 91, I spoke to Schrade about Bobby and about that night and about his theory of the case. Schrade is now getting on in years. This 48-minute conversation may be timeless in what it tells us about the events of that night, about Bobby Kennedy, and about history. Because of that, we're offering this opportunity to listen once again to this very special conversation. First of all, tell us a little bit about your history with Bobby. How did you two get to know each other, and a little bit about your involvement in the campaign back in 68?
Well, I wasn't a real great fan of the Kennedy brothers. We were supporting Adlai Stevenson, 52, 56, and first met them at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. They were coming out of a UAW, United Auto Workers Union, reception area, and they walked up to Walter Ruiz, the president of our union, and me, and said, Jack said, "Walter, how can I get your support for the vice presidential nomination?" And Bob joined in, and Walter said to him, "Young man, you've got to change your voting record," very sternly. And they laughed and left. That was our first contact. In 60, I'd been a president of my local union, United Auto Workers at North American Aviation, and had gone to Detroit to be an assistant to Reuther. And Walter was supporting in 60 Jack Kennedy, but we had an open endorsement policy, and I was campaigning for Stevenson. And at some point, it became evident that Stevenson was not going to actively campaign, but was sort of waiting for the third round and as a candidate and be drafted. And I felt that that was not a very good idea because Lyndon Johnson was also in the race. So I went to Walter and said, "Look, I'm giving up on the Stevenson. I don't think he's that interested in making a fight for it." And Walter, the president of my union, he called Bob Kennedy, and Bob said, "I'll send Paul back to California. He can work on the Stevenson delegates of 52, 56, and bring him over to Jack Kennedy." And I agreed to do that. And that's when I spent a couple of weeks ahead of the convention and worked with Bob, and was very active, and we actually shifted a bunch of Stevenson people over to Jack Kennedy. So that was my first working operation. He was just a wonderful guy to work with, very friendly, delightful, coordinated and effective in working for his brother. Well, a number of things happened at the convention which really cemented my relationship with Bob. The Michigan delegation in the 60 convention was off the floor objecting, as most of the labor union leadership objecting to the Johnson choice for vice president. And I worked with Bob and with Walter Ruther, and was able to get a very liberal statement of Johnson over to the Michigan delegation, which was off the floor, wanted to put up Soapy Williams, the governor of Michigan, as a candidate against Johnson. And when the vice president of our union, Leonard Woodcock, read that statement, you could just feel the pressure go off, and they decided not to oppose Johnson, but sort of vote no on the floor of voice. Anyway, that was the kind of thing that working with Robert Kennedy, and if you can see that you're effective, he would, we built a relationship.
And after the JFK assassination, talk a little bit about your interaction with the Kennedys after that.
Well, Bob was really in bad shape after that. I spent some time with him in Washington at meetings, and he would just sit with his hands clenched and sort of bent over in his chair and just not talk very much. And it took about a year before he actually got out of that period of gloom and suffering over the loss of his brother. And the next thing that happened was we began working with the farm workers union, with Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, back in 65. And there was a Senate committee that Bob was on that was going to investigate this, and Bob was not scheduled to come out. So I made a couple of calls, and Peter Edelman, who worked for Bob, actually convinced Bob to come to California. He spent 2 days in 65, touring, housing, showing how, understanding the farm worker housing was just as bad as what he saw in Mississippi. So he really grabbed onto this. And when we had a hearing at the Delano High School up in the San Joaquin Valley farm area, the sheriff and DA that were there, and the issue was, why are you arresting peaceful pickets? He said, well, they're being threatened by other workers and other people, we're coming out to kill you, get off those picket lines and so forth. And so Bob said, well, that's kind of a strange thing. During lunch break, why don't you go read the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and understand the right to peaceful picketing? And that just brought down the house. Well, following that, there was a very brief conversation with Cesar and Dolores out front. Bob was not very, talkative at some time, but they sort of looked at each other, said a few things, and then we went out and walked the picket line. And I've never been on a picket line with a person holding office, and here a U.S. senator was walking a farm worker picket line of the biggest grape vineyard in California, the DiGiorgio Ranch, which was on strike. And so this was really a wonderful experience, and he really picked up on the movement. And when he was asked to do anything, he would always respond, and it was he built this relationship to a point where 1968, when he started campaigning in California, it was immediately endorsed by Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez, and that became an important part of his campaign. It was that relationship that I had with him was carried over into the farm worker struggle and was very important in his election in 68.
And talk a little bit about that night 48 years ago.
Well, it looked pretty close because there was a stand-in for Hubert Humphrey, and also Gene McCarthy was on the ballot. But the contest was really between McCarthy and Kennedy, and it was very tight. I was doing my job as a union rep at that point, reopening up negotiations with Douglas Aircraft along with President Ruther, my union. And so we also flew up north and came back. I actually voted, of course, early in the morning. We were up north for a meeting, came back, and I was going home because I thought, victory celebrations are not my thing, but the word was out on the radio about 8, 9 o'clock that didn't look too good for Kennedy, so I decided to go down to the hotel. A friend of mine came and said, Bob heard you were here in the hotel, come on upstairs, so we spent the evening waiting for the count and taking phone calls. And it was just a wonderful time because the spirits began lifting as it became closer and closer to his victory in California. At one point, we decided to go downstairs, and Bob and Fred Dutton and Frank Mankiewicz went into a bedroom and went over his notes. And decided to go downstairs. Well, on the way down, he said, look, I don't have Dolores Huertas on my notes, and I understand Cesar Chavez can't be here. Would you write it down? So I did that and ran down the stairs from the fifth floor and caught up with him in the kitchen and went to the embassy ballroom where there's over 1,000 people just cheering away. A lot of young people, very mixed group of supporters. And it was just a, sensational time for me because I had some problems with Reuther over my endorsement of Robert Kennedy. In fact, Lyndon Johnson called Reuther at one point and asked him to get me out of the race after I had endorsed him. And it was before Reuther had made up his mind, but I had totally refused. So it was a real moment of joy for me to be there with him and being thanked by him on the platform as the votes came in for him.
And talk a little bit about what happened afterwards.
Bob was supposed to go off the left side of the platform, but it was understood that he shouldn't go back the way he came in. It's sort of a strategic decision for protection. And I went off and off the left of the platform through the waiter doors into the kitchen and pantry area and waited for him. And he came out the back of the stage alone at that point, which was really strange because his bodyguards weren't with him and Ethel wasn't with him. Ethel was pregnant at that point with Rory, and and so Bob's bodyguard, Bill Barry, who was his official bodyguard, and Rafer Johnson and Rosie Greer were also standing in because these two big guys, and they were behind him. And Bob said to me, "I want you and Jess with me." And I turned around and saw Jess behind us and waved him on. And Bob then stopped and shook hands with a couple of kitchen workers who I got to know. One was Juan Romero, who was the last one to shake hands with Robert Kennedy. And then we moved eastward towards the Colonial Room, which was at the end of the pantry area where the media was waiting for him. And at that point, as we turned and walked eastward, the television lights went on and sort of blinded me. And all of a sudden, I started shaking. I didn't know what happened. I actually felt I was being electrocuted. But I got shot in the head at that point and went down.
When that happened, you were unconscious at the time, correct?
Yeah, I was unconscious at the time and for some time and in and out of consciousness as I was being taken care of. I didn't know for some time that Bob had been shot and four other people had been shot. But I was being taken care of by a friend of mine from the Retail Clerks Union who actually saw me and thought I was dead and put one of the Kennedy campaign hats over my face. But then he felt a heartbeat and took the hat off and put it under my head. Well, at that point, I knew that Bob had been shot, and he knew I'd been shot. And this timing is pretty important because it's important to know that I was shot first. Sirhan got off two shots, missed Robert Kennedy, and I was right behind him, about 6 feet behind him at that point, missed Robert Kennedy and hit me in the top of my head. Then somebody else behind Robert Kennedy shot him. And at that time, Bob's was heard to say by a young student organizer for Kennedy named Weidrich, it was reported by UPI and then the FBI. I didn't really believe the story for some time because I thought it was a little weird that Bob would be that knowledgeable. But he said, Weidrich said he heard Robert Kennedy say, "Is everybody okay? Is Paul all right?" So he was aware at that point. That was confirmed later. I found the FBI statement of Dr. Stanley Abo. Bob must have asked him, too, a few minutes later, because Abo said to Bob, he said, "I just checked on Paul. He's breathing okay. He's going to be all right." And Bob closed his eyes. And I sort of interested in other things he said. The only other thing that I knew he said after that got reported was that when Ethel got to him a few minutes afterwards, because she was pushed down as the bullets started flying by Rafer and Rosie and Bill Barry down on the floor. So when she got to him, he said to her, "Ethel, oh, Ethel," and Ethel said to him, "You you're going to be okay, Bobby. And the last thing I knew that he said was that as he was being lifted on a gurney, don't lift me. And that was it. The horrible, horrible night. And it just, you know, we didn't know for some time whether he was going to live through it, but within 24 hours he had died.
The official version of what happened that night has Sirhan as the only shooter. At what point did you really begin to think that first of all, that wasn't the whole story? And when did you begin to be active in trying to bring to light other facts about it?
Well, I accepted everything. I really was torn apart by this. I wasn't doing my job in the union. I was regional director of the United Auto Workers Union for 100,000 workers in the state of California with a staff of 30. And people began saying to me, Paul, you've got to settle down. You're angry. You're depressed. I finally was defeated and knew I was going to be defeated for office when I was up for re-election in 72. And I just felt, you know, I had to get out of it. And I went back to work in the factory, which is a very quiet, you know, organized place where I could suffer through the rest of this. It was just a terrible, terrible time. But then I kept, during 71, 72, I was still active in the anti-war movement and was one of three co-chairing of the biggest rally in California, about 200,000 people up in San Francisco. And the important point about that was that I met my wife at a party after that, Monica Weil, who became my wife. And that was, you know, a good decision about going back to work and being married, because I sort of had a more settled kind of existence at that point, because it was just horrible getting over the loss of Robert Kennedy, what it did to me, but also what it did to the country and to his family and to a lot of other people who were relying on him. So it was a terrible recovery period. Well, in 74, Allard Lowenstein, who was, you know, head of the Dump Johnson movement, was a member of the Congress, had been a member of Congress, high on the Nixon enemies list. He came to me and to Monica here at our home in L.A. and said, you know, you've got a role to play in this. There's some issues that we think show that, that we don't know everything about what happened that night. He took me down to meet that night a couple of people, and they were right here in our neighborhood, four or five blocks away. Lillian Castellano and Floyd Nelson had actually began investigating the case back in 68, and here it was 74, 75, and I didn't know anything about what they were doing. And actually what they found was that they... some friends of theirs had a photograph of two, what they claimed were two bullet holes in a door frame in the pantry area behind us when we were walking through the pantry. And they tried to get some answers from the LAPD and the DA, but they were fended off. They went public with an LA Free Press article and got some attention, but not very much. They did get the attention of the district attorney, Evel Younger, who said after the trial of Sirhan in 1969, a little over a year after the shooting, that he was going to open up the files. There's lots of information there. We don't want another Dallas, so there'll be full disclosure. But what we found out later in 88, when we got the files out that were locked up, actually, we found out that those two people who said they saw those bullet holes in the door frame, there were actually a destruct order within a few weeks of their announcing this publicly. So here again, we're supposed to get full disclosure, and the files were locked up, and they wouldn't answer any of our questions, and that was a really hard road to go, but we started that in 74, 75, with Alan Lowenstein leading the way, and some really good attorneys at that point that were helping us.
And where did the investigation go from there? Because it seems like there were quite a number of years where it was really dormant.
Yeah, well, what I was able to do is file a lawsuit as a victim against Sirhan and any others that might be involved. And the judge granted us access to the files, but we only got a few photographs. They said we don't have the files, and which was a lie. And so our next move was to ask the court to set up a panel of experts and refire the Sirhan gun to see if they matched the bullets that were in evidence. And we were able to get that. CBS actually came in on the lawsuit, CBS Network, and so we had their attorneys and our attorneys working on this very diligently. Well, I had a right to choose one of the experts, and the other parties did too, Sirhan and the others. So we had seven really great experts go over the evidence, and we were astounded by what we found. They refired the gun and tried to match up against three bullets that the district attorney and the police department submitted to the court and to this panel. The three bullets they sent matched each other. One was the Kennedy neck bullet, the only whole bullet extracted from the four that were shot at Robert Kennedy. And the Wiesel bullet, he got, they were able to extract his bullet, and one from Ira Goldstein, two other victims. Those bullets matched each other, but didn't match the Sirhan gun. Well, the neck bullet wouldn't have matched the Sirhan gun anyway because it was fired by the second gunman. So this was a dilemma that we faced, and we tried to get them to go further with this evidence. But we were blocked by Evel Younger, who is now the attorney general for the state, who was this guy who was for open disclosure. Well, he filed lawsuits. He filed against our having any further testing. So here we are with this expert panel of seven experts saying the bullets don't match the Sirhan gun. And it was a devastating thing because it actually proved there was a second gunman involved because bullet 47, if it matched the other bullets, then there was something happening. Well, our theory, and it's pretty well founded on fact, is that they substituted guns from, substitute bullets from a gun they took out of storage in order to have bullets all coming from the same gun to cover up the Kennedy neck bullet, which came from the second gun. So here we were, with this, all this information, and then the DA at the time and the Attorney General were opposed to anything further, and the judge closed down the case. Well, then there was this long period where we couldn't get into the files. We began fighting for the files, and it was, we went to the grand jury in 72. The grand jury wouldn't hear us, even though we had a right to be heard on the evidence that we had. We also went to the district attorney with, 5,000 documents and all the evidence of the second gunman and the evidence about the Sirhan shots. Anyway, it wasn't until 2008 that we were able to get any further information going. And that was a result of Brad Johnson, a senior writer, now retired from CNN. He found an audio tape in the files. I should have said the files, we actually got the files in 1988, and they went into the California State Archives, a major list came out saying this evidence has been destroyed or is missing, which really, again, complicated the case. Well, Brad Johnson's discovery of that there was an audio tape in the files that had a label on it saying maybe gunshots. Well, there were about 200 audio tapes, but many of them had been destroyed, so there were only 200 left. But out of the 200, there's only one that had any kind of audio evidence, because the media people who, or any people, anyone covering the walk to the media concerts had their tape recorder shut off, and this one guy, a Polish journalist named Brzezinski, hadn't turned it off, and that was the tape that Brad Johnson found. He turned it over to a really great forensic expert, Philip N. Prague, who at that point had like 40 years in forensics and audio tape stuff, working for a lot of the big corporations. And he was able to find 13 shots on that tape and two double shots, which meant that a gun expert and firing a gun similar to Sirhan's could not fire it fast enough to... So the two double shots showed there were actually two guns firing, not fired from the Sirhan gun. So here we had this new evidence, and we took it to the American Academy of Forensic Scientists. They joined us in asking for a reopening of the case. We began moving again to the district attorney here, and also to the chief of police. They wouldn't answer us. They wouldn't. We gave them full files and a book, a textbook on the case written by Dan Prague and his co-author, Robert Joling, who'd been a judge and a lawyer and taught forensics in Arizona College. These two experts put all of this evidence together, all the files together, in a 500-page book, and they published 100 just for lawyers and experts. And so at this point, we were able to advance the case, but again, going to the DA, going to the chief of police, going to the U.S. attorney, going to Holder, and going to Holder, the attorney general of the United States, a friend of the Kennedy family, with a letter from Bobby Kennedy supporting a new investigation. We never heard from them. They just closed the door on us. They wouldn't answer. Now, our understanding of that is they know, we know, that there was a second gunman, that the evidence shows there was a second gunman, and they're just not ready to expose that to the public. And because they know what we know. And we know that there's evidence there of the second gunman that's so clear and concise that any person, even a rookie police officer, would know that there was a second gunman firing that night.
It's easy to see why the district attorney in Los Angeles and the LAPD has resisted the reopening of this. I mean, there was clearly a rush to judgment on their part. They're looking to protect their interest. Why do you think there has been such resistance with respect to the Justice Department?
Well, first of all, we were finally told by the U.S. attorney it's not a federal case. That wasn't any position that Attorney General Holder gave us. He just didn't answer us. But Andre Barat, the U.S. attorney for our section of California, he did one good thing. He facilitated a retest of the gun by the FBI. We got Ben Prague to give his scholarly paper on the evidence of the second gun, the two guns and 13 shots. That went to the FBI lab, so he was cooperating that way. But the lab came back and said they couldn't even find 8 shots of Sirhan on the tape. Then we found out that the Washington Post and certain forensic societies have been really seriously critical of the FBI for a lot of falsified forensics on a lot of gunshot cases. And here we are dealing with a faulty FBI lab and getting a report back saying, you know, that they can't even find 8 shots, and also saying that Ben Craig hasn't cleared this with his fellow scientists, you know, that system. You have new evidence and a new discovery. You've got to do a peer review. Well, what the hell? Here we have this information, and they could have used it. We actually agreed to, I agreed to send Ben Prague to the FBI lab, but that was ignored. Anyway, so here we are. Now it's a local case. The U.S. attorney and the attorney general couldn't have done anything with it, although they could have recommended to the locals to go with it. So it's really a state and local case, and that's where we are at the present time. Sirhan does have a case going. Two really great lawyers, William Pepper and Laurie Dusek, who are operating on the basis that, you know, Sirhan was programmed, and that's been proven with a scientist out of Harvard, a guy from Harvard Medical School, has shown that Sirhan was easily manipulated through hypnosis and probably was programmed. Well, I don't go there with that. What I'm doing is going on the physical evidence and actually going after the prosecutors, indicting them for falsifying evidence, for destroying evidence, and ignoring the fact that that Sirhan was actually a captive after the 2 shots and in no way could have shot Robert Kennedy. The 2 shots at Kennedy, one hit me, missed Kennedy. He was then captured and thrown up against a steam table face down with his gun hand being pounded on the steam table. So his gun was firing away from Kennedy westward and Kennedy was eastward. And that was at the point as he started firing a gun, 6 more shots, according to the audio tape, the second gunman at the same time, they were firing in unison, 6 westward by Sirhan and 4 eastward into Robert Kennedy by the second gunman. So we get over that hurdle of trying to get peer review of the audio tape testing by Van Praag, where he proves 13 shots of 2 guns and 2 different guns shooting in opposite directions. We can now prove that with the fact that Sirhan fired those 2 shots, missed, and then with his hand being pounded on the steam table, shot 4 other people with 5 shots. So here are 2 shots that he got off at me and Robert Kennedy. 5 more shots wounding 4 people, and 1 shot going through one of the guy's pants. Here's proof of 7 shots being fired by Sirhan out of an 8-shot revolver. No chance to reload. He didn't even have extra bullets in his pockets. Here we can prove that those bullets could not have gone into Robert Kennedy. He was firing in a different direction at that point. And the second gunman was firing eastward rather than westward. So here we had the physical evidence that really confirms the Van Praag scientific evidence that he created and analyzing that audio tape. So we're in a hell of a good position at this point to prove the second gun 2 ways. One, by the firing of the gun of Sirhan, two missing Kennedy, 1 hitting me, and the 6 other shots being taken care of. There was no possible way that Sirhan could have fired those 4 shots. First of all, he was not in position, and he was out of bullets. And it's that kind of physical evidence now that we have that proves the Van Praag scientific stuff that they started saying, well, you don't have peer review, which is an asinine position taken by the FBI, by the DA, and by the police chief here.
It's important to point out, too, that over the years, Sirhan's position has been that he remembers none of it.
Yeah, I really believe him, and he understands that, and he says this, if I, you know, confess to this and was able to remember enough, I would have been out of prison a long time ago. He would have been up for parole in 1974. And if he'd been behaving himself from 69 to 74, he would have been out of jail by now. So he's in this terrible position saying, I don't remember, and believing it, and not being able to get out of prison. If he actually was out there saying, yes, I did it, I know I was doing it, did it for this reason, this, and made a total confession, he'd been out of prison by now. So his memory problem is a serious one, and I think that in a way substantiates it, that he knows if he had confessed earlier or done something to clear the record, even though it would be a lie in his own terms, he would have been out of prison.
If, in fact, the case were to be reopened, if, in fact, the investigation were to be reopened, and there was a conclusion on the part of all of the law enforcement authorities, from the Justice Department to the LAPD, and an agreement that there was a second gun, where does that leave things?
See, that's where we are at this point. We know there was a second gun. They won't investigate. They refuse to investigate, and they've refused to investigate for nearly 50 years now, 48 years, and that they'll continue to do that. How we get them to come to that, even to recognize they have a responsibility here, is a very difficult thing to do, because they know what we're saying is correct, because we're on the record. We've got a book on it. We've submitted files to every, you know, to several district attorneys, to this district attorney, Jackie Lacey, to this chief of police, Chief Beck, Charlie Beck. And they know the case, and they know that there was a second gunman, but they're not willing to admit this and put their whole apparatus in some sort of jeopardy. I don't know why truth jeopardizes them. It certainly jeopardizes their integrity as peace officers.
How do you think this will play out at this point?
Well, my first step was to acknowledge what we know about Sirhan, that he didn't do it and couldn't have done it. And that was covered up completely by the investigation. And that's why I went down to visit, because I've been working with his lawyers, although I don't collaborate with them technically, because they have a different strategy and a different case than I do. My case is that the prosecutors actually framed Sirhan and covered up the evidence that he didn't do it, and covered up the evidence of the second gunman. So it's the they accuse kind of position them in, or I'm accusing them of actually not doing their jobs and knowing it. So we're running on parallel courses here, and that's one reason I went down to say to Sirhan, you did not do it, even though you believe you did it and you were convicted for doing it and don't remember doing it. You actually did not do it, and I know that. The evidence shows that clearly, and it's conclusive. So I wanted him to know that somebody was working on this case. And I said to him, and I forgive you for shooting me. You didn't know who I was. I was an innocent bystander. You were there shooting at Robert Kennedy, and this shot me, and then were captured. And you were not able to shoot Robert Kennedy. So I wanted to make it clear to him that there might be some hope in this, that we could get him out of prison. Because in knowing Robert Kennedy here, and knowing him well, Robert Kennedy would be appalled at what they're doing to this guy. They're harassing him. They're holding these parole board hearings and going over his case. Shows he's in there. He's up on good behavior, but refuse to recognize there's evidence that he didn't do it. So that's what made me so angry at that meeting. I was out of control when I was there. But I had, this year I found out that I had victim rights to go to the parole board. That first time I ever knew this. So I applied and said I could, was instructed that I could say anything I wanted, take as much time as I wanted. I would be the last one at the parole board hearing. But after listening for a couple of hours to the parole board people going over his record and talking about it and asking him where he could go if he were released, yes, I could go back to Jordan. I have some family there. That's where my family was. I'm still a citizen of Jordan. Yes, I could go back to Pasadena. My brother is living in our family home. He would take care of me. And in a way, he's sort of tantalizing him with this. And then I just felt really awful for him that they were doing this to him because they were not going to release him. And then the assistant district attorney retired who handles parole board for the district attorney, just went after him viciously based on really false evidence that I knew was wrong, and I contended with him and as he was doing this. Fortunately, there's an AP reporter there, a pool reporter, and he was watching all this. In fact, I was sitting next to him listening to all this, and he could see how agitated I was and how agitated I was when I had a chance to speak out. And then when I started talking to Sirhan, who was across the table about 8 feet away from me, the chairman of the parole board said, "Mr. Schrade, you cannot talk to him directly." I said, "Look, I'm here. I know my victim rights. I'm talking. That's why I'm here. I want to tell him that he didn't shoot Robert Kennedy. And I'm going to do that." And just fended him off and and had to stop a number of times. That I had a prepared statement and tried to read it and did it pretty well, but I got through it. And towards the end, they took a recess and came back and said, "Well, you'll have another hearing in 5 years." it's so horrible. Sirhan, as I was talking, would nod occasionally and was listening very intently to him. But as he moved away from his position on the other end of the table, he was going to come fairly close to me, and he was smiling for the first time and reached out his hand. And I was approaching him so I could shake his hand. They wouldn't allow that. They just yanked him. The guards yanked him and took him back to his cell.
Is it your sense, Paul, that the cover-up, the refusal to reopen the investigation, is covering up on the part of the LAPD and the LA District Attorney's Office, covering up previous incompetence, or is there something more behind it?
Well, there were two cases the year before, 67, there was a Jack Kirschke case, which, every once in a while we'll get a little blip on the screen on that. Back in 74, 75, because the Chief Davis told me, that's the Kirschke case. Well, I didn't pick up on that. Well, what I found out recently, the Kirschke case was a deputy district attorney of District Attorney Evel Younger who shot his wife and her lover in their bed and then tried to cover it up with an alibi. And so Evel Younger had this case going, and it went to went on appeal. The guy was convicted, wasn't jailed, went on appeal. So here, Evel Younger had this sort of scandalous thing happening in his own operation. Well, the appeal court came down in 1975, at the time we first got involved, and they really attacked Younger and his criminalist for near perjurious conduct and showing a number of ways they actually tried to fix this case to make this guy look innocent. Well, this the same thing was, I can't get into the details of each thing that they did in the Kursky case, but there's a parallel situation in the Robert Kennedy case where they did exactly the same thing and got away with it by falsifying evidence and producing false evidence to the jury, so the California appeal court actually attacked the criminalists and Younger for their behavior in that case. And that's repeated over in the Robert Kennedy case. So it becomes a very big political thing, for particularly for Evel Younger, who was running for attorney general during the Robert Kennedy Sirhan case, and had this Kursky case in his background as well. So I think there's a lot of politics involved in this thing, mainly based upon what Evel Younger's ambitions were at that point, mm-hmm. and why he was trying to cover up, and he did. He covered up the second gunman and covered up the fact that Sirhan was a captive after two shots and was unable to shoot Robert Kennedy, and they knew that.
And Paul, when you look at our politics today, what do you think Robert Kennedy would think of where we are today?
Tough one. I don't know if he can even answer that. Such a good person, and developed very rapidly. You know, when he became probably the best political person I ever known, and really deep into problems that people were facing, poor people, people of color, different origins, and so forth. He was really a great human being. That you could see developing right from 1956 when I first met him until 68. So he would be appalled at what was happening now. And I think the other speculation is if he had lived, would we be the same as we are now with mm-hmm. the terrible politics of the Republican Party and this horrible person, Donald Trump, running for president? Again, you know, try to predict on A from what's all about this is hard to do.
Paul Schrade, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Thank you for being with us. And thank you for listening and for joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shechtman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.